From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, State Senator Daryl Steinberg, one of the key figures in California's recent controversial budget deal, gives his take on what happened. Also, a Davis writer who's had success with Chick Lit writes her first suspense book. And Clark Reaper Tales, a new local novel about a bounty hunter who saves the Wild West from huge insects and space aliens. But first, tomorrow is Kevin Johnson's 100th day as Sacramento mayor. How has he done? Capital Public Radio news reporter Ben Adler has talked with Johnson, city council members, and others for a story that airs tomorrow morning, and he joins us. Ben, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks. I'm glad to be part of the show you got lined up. It's quite a variety.
It is indeed. Well, back to Kevin Johnson. What's the consensus on how he's done so far?
Well, to be concise, which is something I'm not very good at, the general consensus is a rocky start, but he's moved on nicely.
Let's talk about some of the council members, because the council members, some of them lined up with him as he was running for mayor, and some of them lined up against him. One of the council members that liked Kevin Johnson when he was running was Steve Cohn.
Yeah, Steve Cohn, Sandy Sheedy, and Robbie Waters are the three who endorsed the mayor during the campaign. Since then, Councilman Waters has largely stuck by the mayor's side. Steve Cohn usually has two. Sandy Sheedy's gone back and forth a little bit, at least publicly. And, you know, Steve Cohn, I think, shares a frustration with the mayor that the city is occasionally just too process-oriented. And I think that's one thing where he and the mayor really see eye to eye. And he talked about it a little bit with me the other day.
That's another thing you'll often hear him talk about, is Sacramento tends to be too process-oriented. And you know what? He's probably right. We probably are, compared to many other cities. Because of our nature as the state capital, we have a lot of activists that live in our city, which is great on the one hand, but sometimes it can stifle initiative. And I think it's a good balance to have somebody like Kevin pushing the envelope, but at the same time, you know, have some scrutiny in terms of whether it's the council or the public.
What did Steve Cohn think about this theory that Johnson had a rough start but recovered reasonably well?
He agreed with that. He very much agreed with that. And I believe I'm going off the top of my head, I also think he kind of agreed with the fact that the mayor's had a very strong outside game in terms of his public appearances and events like the education summit he had yesterday with the chancellors of the D.C. and New York City school systems. Also, he's been on, you know, the mayor's been on CNN and he's been on, you know, Fox News, and he's really elevated the profile of the city, and that's something that I think Councilman Cohn and most other people give the mayor a lot of credit for. I think Councilman Cohn and others, I think, recognize that there's a bit of a learning curve on the inside game, and that's, I think, something we saw throughout the first 100 days, is the mayor grappling with that as he brought forth a proposal for changing the city charter to make it a strong mayor system of government, which got a lot of resistance from the council at first and in a couple other instances as well. And that takes learning for anyone who's new to government.
So that proposed change to the charter right off the bat, that was the rocky start.
It accounted for a great deal of the tension at City Hall between the mayor and some council members. And the way I understand it is the mayor did not give the council members a heads up that he was going to propose this until the day of, and when it and that day it wasn't the mayor himself, but it was a staff member who called the council members and mentioned, our transition team has drafted an initiative to change the city charter, and we're going to go public with it today. And a lot of council members were rankled by that. A lot of them do feel that the charter needs to be redone. It hasn't been done in major substantive changes in, you know, nearly 100 years or so. But they didn't feel that was the most appropriate way to do it. They wanted to have input, too. And that's where you get into the various, you know, egos on the city council and how it's important when you want to move things forward to have that inside game of meeting with various council members and bringing them along.
Another council member you spoke with was Ray Trathaway. Why did you choose him?
I chose him because he supported Mayor Fargo. He certainly criticized the mayor on a certain agenda item back in January, which is an external audit, an independent third-party audit of city finances, which was low cost and low risk, but also was a no-bid contract. And another example of the mayor proposing something but not really bringing the council along. And the Council, by and large, sent a message to the mayor by turning it down. You know, the mayor was very frustrated about that because he feels we're giving up, we the city is giving up, you know, a chance to have great independent outside advice as we head into a rough budget year because the I's weren't dotted and the T's weren't crossed. But the council members, many of them argued that process really does matter. And there's process for process's sake is one thing, but process for democracy's sake is quite another. And so Trethewey is very critical on that, but he also has, I think, more than some other members of the council who supported Mayor Fargo, really tried to work with Mayor Johnson. They've appeared at some public events. They last week were involved along with Steve Cohn in negotiations over a controversial issue that's coming to council tonight, which is what to do with a public subsidy for the 1000 block, the 1000 block of K Street. And Trethewey when I spoke with him yesterday, really had some good things to say about the mayor. And he talked about how the mayor is working on his inside game.
Certainly every outsider to government wants to do things, get things done yesterday. Inside, there's a process. You know, in democracy, there's no I. It's all the people. It's everybody gets to touch the item and put their 2 cents worth in. So the inside game is much, much different. And part of it can be exasperating, but the other part is exhilarating because things really do get done. So I think he's actively learning, quite frankly.
That's Sacramento City Council member Ray Trethewey speaking with Capital Public Radio news reporter Ben Adler. Tomorrow is the 100th day in office for Kevin Johnson as the mayor of Sacramento. And Ben is working on a story that will air tomorrow morning about this first 100 days. What about Johnson himself? You spoke with him today.
I did. And he has long been frustrated, I think, even as he ran for mayor. He talked about sometimes, you know, we have a process just for the sake of having a process. And getting on the inside, I think, you know, that's one of his frustrations too. And I asked him about that today.
For me, it's about council understanding that our mindset for a city cannot be a city that's against everything and for nothing. We have to have a can-do attitude. We have to find ways to get things done and make them happen and not just say, we need more time.
So the mayor, you know, despite that, I think about halfway through did change course. I think he still feels very strongly that you've got to have a can-do attitude. He said in a State of the City speech a couple weeks back, we cannot in Sacramento be afraid to try. We cannot be afraid to fail. We have to be, you know, action-oriented. We have to move forward on things. But on the strong mayor is, you know, the one big issue that kind of got the tensions flaring a bit at City Hall. He did take a step back for a couple of reasons. One is he was originally hoping to get it on a June special election ballot. Well, the election's in May. They aren't going to be able to get it on in time. And they decided to push it back. Also, it's a chance to take that off the table, be less of a distraction, to build relationships with the council. And, you know, I think those are there are some reasons that he chose to change course, and a lot of council members are pleased that he did that. A couple of them have mentioned that they're working very hard on building relationships with him, including those who on both sides of you know, whether they supported the old mayor or the new mayor in the election. So I think it's important, while we focused a lot in this brief appearance on some of the tensions and some of the tough times that the mayor's had, that he really has made a lot of ground up in the eyes of many members of the council, and that there's a lot of optimism, I think, at City Hall about the next 100 days.
Finally, Ben, something that's in the news right now, and that is negotiations between the city of Sacramento and the unions. The police union has agreed to some concessions, and the city is looking to use that as leverage with some others, correct?
They are absolutely trying to use the deal that will be officially approved by council at tonight's meeting with the police union, the Sacramento Police Officers Association, to pressure the union that represents firefighters and the union that represents the bulk of non-public safety employees to reach similar concessions, to give up or rather delay cost of living increases, and for non-public safety employees to agree to furloughs. And by doing so, that would allow the city to basically cut its upcoming $50 million budget deficit for the fiscal year that starts July 1st in half. The city, both council members and city officials, have made zero pretense about this. They've been absolutely clear. Because the police union has made a deal with us, there will be no further cuts to the police department. If the fire union agrees, there will be no further cuts to the fire department. And they are very much hoping to use this police deal to pressure the fire union especially and also other unions to come to the table.
Ben Adler's story about Kevin Johnson's first 100 days as mayor airs tomorrow morning on the station just after 6:30 and 8:30. Ben Adler, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, we'll talk with Senator Daryl Steinberg, one of the key figures in California's budget deal, giving his take on what happened. Also, Davis Ryder, who's had success in romance, writes her first suspense book. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can get a daily RSS feed telling you what's on Insight. Sign up at capradio.org/insight. A Davis author who's had success in the romance genre, more specifically chick lit, has turned her hand to suspense. Eileen Carr's latest novel is called Hold Back the Dark. We spoke with her on Insight a couple of years ago under the name Eileen Randall, the name she uses as a romance author. Eileen Carr is in our studio. Eileen, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much.
Why the different names?
We wanted to make it clear to people which kind of book they were getting. We thought that if somebody was expecting one of my sort of lighthearted, funny, chick lit novels and picked up this one, which was very dark and very tense and very gritty, that they might feel there was a little bit of false advertising there or be a little disappointed. So we wanted to make sure that they knew what they were getting.
And where do the names Carr and Randall come from? Are they actual names that you use?
Randall is actually my name. Carr, basically my publisher picked it. I have to say, they said they when we decided to do a pseudonym, they said they wanted something short and near the beginning of the alphabet. And I tried all kinds of different combinations of my kids' names and maiden name and all kinds of different things. And I came home one day to find an email from my editor at about 1 o'clock California time saying, we need a name and a new title by the end of the day today, which meant it was already 4 o'clock in New York. So at the end of her message was, how about Hold Back the Dark by Eileen Carr? And I said, fine.
Really?
It'll be fine.
Wow, because Eileen Randall sounds to me more like a suspense writer, and Eileen Carr sounds like a chick lit writer.
They wanted something with a hard sound to it, the car with the k yeah. sound. And apparently there's some sort of publishing idea about having your name at the beginning of the alphabet being somehow a good thing.
Because you show up more readily, I guess, on shelves.
And maybe by the time they've gotten to R, they've run out of money to spend. I don't know.
Why did you decide to write a suspense book after writing 4 chick lit books?
There were a lot of reasons behind it. The chick lit market, I think, had gotten somewhat glutted. And I'd always wanted to be in more than one genre to start with, so I was looking for something else to try, something new to try, and I've always loved suspense novels. I grew up, my father was a big mystery reader, mysteries and spy stories, so that was what was all around our house as a kid, so I read tons of those and always loved them. But the real start of this book came on a bike ride with some friends. I bike ride usually once a week with two friends. One is a clinical psychologist and one is another novelist. And we started out our ride and I said, you know, I need to try something different. I need to do something new. And the clinical psychologist said, I've always wanted to write a psychological thriller. And, you know, all that stuff they make you take out of your chick lit novels because it's too dark, you could put them all in a psychological thriller. So by the time we'd ridden from Davis to Winters and back, we actually sort of had a rough idea of how this book was going to go.
Goodness. Give us the elevator pitch of the story of the novel.
A clinical psychologist's teenaged client is found catatonic between her parents' murdered bodies. And my psychologist has to prove that her client didn't kill her parents.
Can you give us any idea where this came from? Is this some ripped from the headlines thing?
No, it really started. I think it was one of the interesting things about working it out with a clinical psychologist. We started actually with the client and why she would be seeing a psychologist in the first place and what that would mean. And we really worked backwards to figure out what had happened to this girl to bring her to this point, and then moved forwards through the plot of the book.
Wow. Eileen Carr is a novelist. She lives in Davis. All her books until now, under the name Eileen Randall, have been in the chick lit genre. She's now has her first suspense novel, Hold Back the Dark, and you're going to read for us.
I do have a little excerpt to read to you.
Anything we need to know before you start the reading?
This is this takes place at the hospital. It's the first time my detective, my hero, who is a police detective, and my heroine, the clinical psychologist, meet, and she's going in to see her client, who is in the emergency room. And she's just asked if she can go in to see her. And the scene is from the detective's point of view. If she could get the girl to do something besides make little animal noises, maybe they could get some information out of her. It was entirely possible that this girl held the key to the case. If she hadn't done it, she may well have seen something that could break the thing wide open. Of course, be my guest. The uniformed officer pulled the curtain aside again and stepped through. Taylor, she said, her low voice quiet. Taylor, it's me, Dr. Gannon. If Taylor heard her, she gave no sign. She continued rocking and making the whimpering noises she'd been making since she'd been found. Gannon knelt beside the girl, placing her hand lightly on her back. Taylor, it's all right, you're safe now, she murmured. Taylor rocked faster. No one here is going to hurt you, Gannon said. Taylor kept rocking. Can you tell me what happened? What happened to your parents? To you, Taylor, can you tell me what happened to you? Gannon's voice was nearly a whisper, as if her throat had constricted. Taylor didn't even look at her. Gannon turned the force of her blue eyes onto Josh, who now leaned against the counter that ran along the side of the cubicle, arms folded across his chest, legs crossed at the ankle in front of him. Fatigue dragged at him like cement boots. He'd been on duty for 18 hours, and everything that happened in these first few hours of the investigation was crucial. Mess up now? And he could find himself in the kind of quagmire that never got fully resolved and would leave a stain on his record. He'd push through it. It wasn't like he hadn't done it before. People expected homicides to be cleared up fast. People especially expected to have homicides involving upstanding citizens who were knitting in their homes when they were bound and strangled to be cleared up lightning fast. She's in shock, Gannon said. Really? Wolf said. Did she think he was an idiot? He was hoping for some way to bring Taylor out of shock that didn't involve a slap across the face. I'd never have guessed. Gannon's eyes narrowed and her lips pursed. Do you have a plan to deal with that? She was cute when she was mad, especially with those hot librarian glasses. Not that he was noticing or anything. Calling you pretty much was my plan.
Eileen Carr reading from her first suspense novel, Hold Back the Dark. Now, this character, Amy Gannon, is a clinical psychologist. Does she resemble in any way your friend, the psychologist who helped you come up with this idea?
And philosophically, very much. I have to say my friend who helped me, whose name is Carol, by the way, who helped me come up with this idea, was amazing through the whole process of the book. She read this book in so many different versions, unedited, messy, nasty versions, just because it was important to me that my character not do something that would make every therapist out there roll her eyes and bang her head on the floor. I wanted her to behave in a way that was appropriate for a therapist and upstanding and ethical for a therapist.
Every time I've asked someone in a profession that is fictionalized a lot, does fiction actually resemble what you really do? They always say, not really, or sometimes much worse than that. How important was it to you that a psychologist could read this book and go, wow, this is what it's actually like, albeit maybe, you know, a fictionalized version?
It was very important to me. I wanted to stay true to that. That said, there were a number of scenes where I have my heroine having to hassle with the insurance companies to get paid that my editor cut, which my friend originally said, yes, this is what it's really like. But I didn't want her to do anything that would make someone feel she was too stupid to live and or too stupid to have the job that she had. I wanted my reader to be able to respect her.
Along with your new suspense novel and your four chick lit books, you also contributed to a book called Grey's Anatomy 101.
Oh, yes, I did.
You wrote an essay for that. It was a book that came out, I guess, about a year and a half ago. And it's a series of essays about the TV show Grey's Anatomy. How did you come to write something for that book?
That was sort of a friend of a friend of a friend thing. I think sometimes you get yourself into a community of writers and things come to you. I had several friends who had written for Ben Bella Books on different pop culture topics, and they had contacted me to see if I could write an essay for them on Grey's Anatomy. And I loved that show.
Loved? You said that
I
was
did.
Past tense. What do you not like about it?
No. I don't want to run anybody down. Oh, it kind of went off the rails for me a little bit.
Jumped the shark?
Probably not quite there yet, but close enough. I frustrate my family. I tend to only like the first two seasons of any TV show, and then I hit a point where I say, okay, I'm done. I need something new now.
I think it's a pretty reasonable TV philosophy. What was your essay about?
My essay was actually about how sluttiness was saving Meredith. That really what she got when she got into trouble is when she actually fell in love. When she was just sleeping with anybody who walked through the doors of the bar, she was fine.
Did you approach it tongue-in-cheek or were you writing it seriously?
A little bit of both. I mean, I think that's one of the things about writing popular fiction is that when you're looking at any popular genre, TV shows, movies that other people kind of pass off just as entertainment, I'm always looking a little bit deeper. I make my family crazy when it's like, well, what do you suppose her motivation was to do that? Do you really think that this is true to her character? And it's like, we don't really want to talk about this anymore. So it was, for me, it was a real pleasure to get to delve more deeply into why she behaved that way romantically and how the other characters in the show surrounding her reflect different ways of dealing with love and sex. So it was actually very fun that way.
On the Amazon page for the book Grey's Anatomy 101, one of the comments really stood out for me. It was this person called M. Findlay in Vermont saying, I was looking for some academic essays focusing on this show. And that kind of surprised me.
People will surprise you in many ways.
Eileen Carr, novelist. She lives in Davis. Her latest book is a suspense novel, Hold Back the Dark. But as Eileen Randall, you've written four chiclet books. Are you going to go back to that genre? You said you were getting a little tired maybe of it.
Oh, I love the chiclet books. I love those stories. And there's probably a few more that I would love to write. I'm not sure when I'm going to get to do that. Actually, my next book that comes out after this one, which doesn't come out till April of 2010, is an urban fantasy that takes place in Sacramento.
So that's going to be neither chiclet nor suspense, is that right?
Exactly.
New name?
I don't know yet. I actually talked to the publisher, my editor, about it a little bit, and we're kind of on the fence. My agent just puts her head in her hands and goes, three names? Three names? I don't think you can do three names. Like, oh, we'll see. But I'm almost finished writing the rough draft of that one, and it's been so much fun to write.
How is it different from the style of the other books you've written?
I would say style-wise, it's more similar to my chiclet novels. It's in first-person point of view, and the romantic suspense is in third-person. And definitely the heroine has a very sort of sarcastic way of looking at things, which is very much like my chiclet novels were. That said, it's been interesting to write because it's also sort of a detective story as she tries to unravel what's happening in Sacramento that involves Chinese vampires living under old Sacramento and grow houses in Elk Grove and how they're all connected. So it's sort of a detective novel, and it's also, you've got werewolves and vampires and pixies and imps, and then there's also a very strong romance thread. So it's really been sort of like a braiding process as I go through it.
Maybe you could hyphenate your two author names.
Randall Carr.
Eileen Carr, she lives in Davis. She's a novelist. She writes in two, now soon to be three genres. Her latest book is her first suspense novel, Hold Back the Dark. She speaks this evening at the Borders Bookstore in Davis. It's at 7 o'clock. Eileen, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
This is Insight. Now we continue our series on what happened and why in California's long heated budget talks. Last Friday, we spoke with one of the most controversial figures in the whole process, Republican Senator Abel Maldonado, who eventually crossed party lines to vote with the Democrats on the final deal. Today, we'll talk with one of the central figures, the top Democrat in the upper house of the California legislature, Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg. Senator, welcome back to Insight.
Nice to be with you, Jeffrey.
Why did it take so long to come up with this deal?
Well, because we were dealing with a $41 billion problem, the largest deficit in the history of the state of California. And I might say for myself, I got sworn in as the Senate leader on December 1st. And it did take, of course, until the end of February to get this done. But I promise you, I worked every single day of those first 80 days or so on nothing but the budget. California's been hit worse, really, in many respects than the rest of the country. And here's one statistic for you. Between September 2008 and June 2010, the analysts estimate we will have lost over $30 billion in revenue alone. And so this was hopefully a once-in-a-lifetime experience, quite a trial by fire for me, but we got it done.
In order to get the two-thirds vote that is required in California for the budget, you needed a few Republican votes, three in the Senate, and I think it was the same number in the State Assembly. Did you have problems holding on to the Democrats before you even were able to get some Republicans over?
Well, I must tell you that I was very proud of the Senate Democratic Caucus, because I think to a person, they would all say that they did not like elements of this budget. They didn't, and I didn't come to Sacramento to cut $8.5 billion of public education funding or to make some of the other difficult decisions that we did. But people hung in there, and there was really no question, especially as we got to the last 5 days, that every Democrat would vote for the budget. And it sort of comes with governing. And if I have some frustration with the minority party here, with the exception of the six who in fact did step up and put the state first, is that many of them frankly put ideology before saving the state. And you can say a lot of things about the Democrats in this chapter of California history, but certainly every member stepped up and helped save the state.
Given the nature of passing budgets here where you need the two-thirds vote, but
yes,
the Democrats, the majority party, did not have that, were a little bit short, how do you set about negotiating with people who have a disproportionate amount of power? Because those three Republican votes were the difference between passing a budget and not passing a budget.
Absolutely. And, I know you had Senator Maldonado on your show last week, and frankly, a lot of us were not happy with the process that led to the placement of the open primary on the June 2010 ballot. But at 2 o'clock in the morning, two Thursdays ago, as the state was literally hours away from issuing stop work orders on almost 300 major transportation and other public works projects, resulting in the unemployment of thousands of people, I said to my caucus, I said, we're staring into the abyss here, and we have to get this job done. And so we did it. Now, here's the remedy. The remedy is to change this two-thirds supermajority requirement to pass a budget in California. It's ridiculous. We're one of three states that has this requirement, and it in fact does empower a small minority of members to hold up, not only the passage of the budget in terms of its timing, but to have a disproportionate impact on the substance of the budget as well. And this is a great example. The open primary, frankly, whether you agree with it or disagree with it, has nothing really to do with the state budget. And yet, it was a necessary piece of gaining the minimum number of Republican votes to be able to avoid an economic catastrophe in California.
I'm talking with Senator Daryl Steinberg, President Pro Tem of the California State Senate. He's a Democrat who represents the Sacramento area. We're talking with a few senators over a period of days about what happened during the lengthy budget negotiations that were finally resolved, or hopefully resolved, I guess one might more correctly say.
Hopefully. We have to pass the May 19th ballot measures. If we do not, the state will automatically fall into another $6 billion hole. So I'm campaigning hard and actively for the ballot measures on May 19th.
Do all six measures have to pass?
They do not all have to pass, but frankly, given the limited period of time, I think it's going to be very hard to distinguish one measure from the other. And they're going to have to be the campaign is going to have to package them. And so I think it's very difficult to say, well, I'm for these three, but not for the other two. You know, one of the measures, Jeff, is to take $450 million from Proposition 63, which is the mental health initiative that I put my heart and soul into sponsoring. And it's the last thing in the world I want to do, and yet I'm supporting it because, again, we were dealing with a $41 billion problem, and we have a chance to solve it.
Proposition 1A on the May 19th statewide special election ballot approves a temporary raising of taxes and in return would limit future state spending. It's my understanding that there are people on both the left and the right who are opposed for different reasons to that proposition. That seems like there could be a war on two fronts.
Well, it's a political problem, no question about it. But when you have, you know, the far left and the far right both opposing something, maybe it means it's a pretty good idea. The truth of the matter is, it's a rainy day reserve. That's what it is. It's not a spending cap in the traditional sense that the Republicans have advocated. What it simply says is that when the state is flush with revenue, we ought to put enough of it away so that when we have bad times, we can in fact not cut as much. And so I'm comfortable with it. I mean, I helped negotiate it, and I know that the alternative could have been a very hard, rigid spending cap that would have made it impossible to reinvest in health and human services and education. But that isn't what this is. In addition, of course, and you point out why the Howard Jarvis people don't like it, we're not going to be through this economic crisis overnight, and to pass this means two additional years of needed revenue to avoid even deeper cuts to public education and health care for Californians.
It's my impression that there's not strong support for the open primary measure in the legislature that would open up primaries, political primaries in California. Are people's reticence about this because they have a fundamental concern about having open primaries, or is it the way that the issue has been put onto the ballot, i.e. as a concession, a last-minute concession in budget talks?
A little of both, but 2.5 weeks after the event, as we call it, there's no question that people are feeling like the process itself was not a great process. Again, you know, you give Senator Maldonado, who's a good man, you know, the credit for leveraging it in a way. But I just don't – I think it is symptomatic of what's wrong with the two-thirds requirement in the first place. It shouldn't have come to that. The budget should be about making necessary expenditure reductions and raising necessary revenue. And all these tangential issues that get brought in, I think, are a direct result of the fact that we've empowered through this two-thirds requirement a small minority of legislators to dictate the outcome. You can't blame them for taking advantage of it, but it doesn't make it right.
If you could go back to December 1st when you took over as president pro tem, is there anything you would do differently in this whole budget negotiation process?
Well, I'm sure there were some things that I would do differently, but I must tell you, I'm proud of three things. I'm proud of the fact that we avoided an economic catastrophe, because that would have been the result had we failed to put together the two-thirds supermajorities necessary to pass the largest deficit, or reduce the largest deficit in history. Secondly, I'm proud of the fact that despite the size of the deficit, we largely protected the poor and health and human services. We barely made a dent. And three, I'm proud of the fact that even though public education took a big cut, that with the passage of Prop 1B, we will fully restore the funding level that existed prior to the cuts being made. So for a $41 billion problem, not bad. I'm proud of it. I'm proud of, you know, the people who stepped up and, again, put California ahead of any ideology or any other interests. You know, you cannot pick your timing when you are elected leader. And certainly, I was elected leader at a difficult time. But I'm now, you know, I think it was good for me and solidified my caucus and showed people that, you know, I can be both conciliatory and tough when I need to. And now I'm ready to tackle some positive agendas here in California. We have so much to do: healthcare, renewable energy, water, career pathways for high school students, and the dropout rate. There's so much work, you know, to do, and now I can, you know, with my colleagues, really begin doing it.
You said earlier that if the voters do not pass these six propositions on May 19th, then the deal will fall apart. But if they do pass them, what does that mean for the usual annual budget talks in the summer?
Well, first of all, we passed the action we took in February actually was the passage of the 2009-10 budget, ironically the earliest budget in state history. Too late in many respects, and yet early. So it means we don't face the constitutional deadline. Now, even if we pass the measures on May 19th, and I'm confident we will, there will still be a continued natural downturn of the economy. And I expect that we will see a drop of, you know, $5 to $6 billion of revenue. But with the reserve that we have, and depending on the amount of federal money that we gain, we can manage that. It'll be much more difficult to manage if it becomes a $10 or $12 billion problem.
So if the deficit that's accumulating now is only about $5 billion, you think the state can absorb it without cutting significant services or raising significant taxes and fees?
Well, we can offset that kind of number, not all of it, not dollar for dollar, but a good portion of it with the reserve and with federal funds. But if it goes much beyond that, I don't think we're going to be able to do that. So we got to pass those measures on May 19th.
And finally, Senator, I'm sure your family was also quite relieved when the budget talks were over, because you and your colleagues were putting in an awful lot of time, including late night sessions at the Capitol.
I have a wonderful wife who really, you know, is a partner in terms of bolstering me through this. But I'll be honest, I've been through a lot of difficult negotiations, never anything quite like this. 45.5-hour session, the longest session in Senate history. And, you know, I think it's taken about 2 weeks here to really get back to, quote, normal life. But you can't do it without a supportive family. I'm very, very lucky to have that, and great colleagues. I mean, as hard as this was, again, I go back to at least my own caucus, nobody likes sleeping in the Capitol. Nobody likes sleeping on couches or on beds or staying up all night. Almost to a person, the members said, we're not going home until this gets done. We needed one more vote, as it turned out, and we got it. And I think California still has a long way to go, but California is the better for it.
Senator Daryl Steinberg, President Pro Tem of the California Senate, thank you so much for joining us.
Always, Jeff. Talk to you soon.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, Clark Reaper Tales, a new novel by a local author about a bounty hunter who saves the Wild West from huge insects and space aliens. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Insight will soon move to a new time on Monday, March 23rd. Listen for us at 10 a.m. Some other program changes also happen that day. For information, go to capradio.org. Clark Reaper Tales, a mix of science fiction and Western, is the first novel by a young local author. It's about a bounty hunter who saves the West from such horrors as huge insects, demons, and space aliens. The author is Michael Panish, and he wrote Clark Reaper Tales while still at high school. He's now 19. Michael Panish, welcome to Insight.
Thank you for having me.
What gave you the idea to combine science fiction and Western into one new genre?
Well, it started when a friend and I were looking through a zombie comic. The Walking Dead was the title of it. And in one panel, it showed the main character with a cowboy hat. And my friend looked at this, and he hummed the famous opening theme to Sergio Leone's The Good and the Bad and the Ugly. And I instantly thought, you know, a Western would be a lot better with some zombies in it.
Why? What would the zombies add?
Well, I've always been a fan of zombies. You know, it's always an interesting situation when the zombies rise up and start munching on the living. But I figure it's just been done so much in various movies and books and all sorts of things. So putting it in a new setting would be very interesting. And the Old West is a very interesting setting.
Have you read many novels and stories about the Old West? I gather you're more interested in the zombie end of things.
Oh, no. It's very important. It was very important for me to be at the right sort of tone. Realism was not too big of an issue, but I certainly wanted the Western tone to be right. So I read a great variety of Western books. I read Owen Wister's The Virginian, which was published in 1902, I think, and is considered to be the first Western. I read some of the Western short stories of Elmore Leonard, which were very good. And I also read some other weird Western stories that combined the Western with horror and science fiction elements by authors like J.R. Lansdale.
Michael Panish, his new novel is called Clark Reaper Tales. That's spelled R-E-E-P-E-R, by the way. It's subtitled The Truthful Telling of the Adventures of the West's Wildest Bounty Hunter. You're going to read from the book for us. This is from the first story called Dead Man's Gulch. What do we need to know before you start the passage?
Well, in this passage, it talks about how Clark is pursuing his target, a gunman by the name of Fire-Eyed Dick. Clark was hired by a scientist named Doc Torrent to find Fire-Eyed Dick after the gunman attacked Doc Torrent's lab and stole his prize experiment. But it's a little bit more than that, as you'll soon see. Dick's trail was as wild as a drunk man's wanderings. I chased him all over North Dakota, across desert and forest, until I caught up with him in a saloon in Deadwood. He was a thin rod of a man, completely covered by a black cloak and a wide-brimmed hat. Black leather gloves even covered his hands. A burning light seemed to shine through his hat brim, and I began to think he weren't all human. I decided dead was better than alive in this situation. I fired at Fire-Eyed Dick from behind with a trusty 12-gauge, and that should have torn the feller apart. Instead, the gunman swung around and laid into me with a fist made of solid steel. When he hit me, his entire body spun completely around, so that the tips of his boots were pointed the opposite way as his blazing eyes. He got up and ran out of the place, his feet still pointed backwards. After I had picked myself up off the floor and wheezed for a minute or two, I was hot on his trail. I caught up with Fire-Eyed Dick and shot off his hat with my Colt Peacemakers as he was riding out of town on a stolen horse. Without his hat, I saw that Fire-Eyed Dick didn't have much of a face at all. It was a metal rod with two light bulbs sticking out, and it was the light bulbs that gave him that glow. See, it turns out that Fire-Eyed Dick didn't steal Doc Torrent's experiment. He was the experiment. Torrent had been trying to make a mechanical man with something like a clattering cash register for a brain and a steam engine for a heart. He had succeeded a little too well. That was why Doc Torrent was paying so much for me to kill the mechanical man. He knew that Fire-Eyed Dick would wise up quickly. Someone had to shut him down before he caused too much trouble. I reckon I was being paid to be that someone.
Michael Panish reading from his first published book, Clark Reaper Tales. Did this start off as a short story and then it expanded into something bigger?
Yes, it did. But even when I was working on the zombie story, I intended that the two main characters, Clark and his adopted son, Charles Green, would travel all around the West and encounter all sorts of bizarre occurrences and crazy creatures, as well as historical movements and figures.
One thing that's really striking about the book are the illustrations. They're really quite funny in a morbid sort of way. Like, for example, the picture, it's early on in the book, of this dead horse that's being ridden by a man, and he's got like a fishing rod with a severed hand that's tempting the horse forward.
Oh, yeah.
Where do these wonderful drawings come from?
Well, my illustrator's name is Jake Delaney. We met in Cub Scouts a long time ago, and we were in high school together. And he was always doodling, and his doodles were amazing. And every time there was a school project that involved art, he was always, you know, the group's designated artist, and he was always very good. And I gave him some of my stories to look over, and he seemed to enjoy them. And I was always trying to get him to try illustrating some of them, because I would really like to see my creations, you know, appearing on the page in line and in ink and everything. But for our senior project, what we decided to do the book for that, it provided the excuse he needed. So I finally got him to get some illustrations for the book, and he's done a wonderful job.
Did you tell him what you thought Clark Reaper looks like?
Yes. The book does give a quick it gives a detailed explanation of what he, of his appearance. And Jake, you know, quickly designed something. I looked it over, and, you know, everything from the stubble to the duster, the Stetson, the gun, all of it was just as I imagined. So he interpreted the work very well.
Clark Reaper has an adopted son. He's 10 years old. He's got spectacles on, and he looks almost like he's wearing a little military uniform. Why did you give Clark Reaper a 10-year-old bespectacled adopted son?
Well, Charles Green, who is Clark's son, I added that because I thought it would be very interesting to combine this bounty hunter, a man who makes his living off of death and gun smoke, and sort of pair him up with a child, you know, someone who is innocent, but has strong moral convictions, and idolizes Clark in a way that he perhaps, you know, doesn't realize how violent and cruel Clark can possibly be. Together they sort of he changes Clark's attitude towards life over the course of the book.
This is a published book, but you've also had many stories appearing in online magazines, quite a variety of them. Demon Minds, Fantastic Horror. I love the name Tiny Globule.
Oh, yes.
And Defenestration.
Oh, yes. They all have good names.
For people who are not familiar with these magazines, what are they about?
Well, they appear, they're online periodicals, and they take submissions from all kinds of authors. Each one is a little bit different in exactly what they want. The Tiny Globule, I think it both reprints classic science fiction stories as well as asking for new ones. And yeah, each of them is a little bit different. They range from, you know, dark horror to humor, as in the case of Defenestration. And I think I sold a Clark Reaper story to Defenestration, but the other ones have all been various other characters and series that I've worked on.
Where did the name Clark Reaper come from, especially with that unusual spelling, R-E-E-P?
Well, it just sort of popped into my head. I really didn't need to think too hard of what a gunslinger and a bounty hunter's name would be. And Reaper, of course, you know, brings to mind the Grim Reaper. I'm a big fan of meaningful names, almost as much as I like alliteration in my characters' names. And having, you know, Clark Reaper just brings to mind this image. It's a typical American first name, as well as a last name which brings to mind the Grim Reaper causing death and Clark's career as a bounty hunter.
Is writing a hobby, or do you plan for this to be your career?
It is my dream for this to be my career, and I do probably spend more time than just a hobby writing. I write as much as I can, and you know, my parents and sister always try and force me out of the computer, so I, you know, when I'm just trying to get a few more words in or finish a sentence. But yes, I have not really considered what my exact career would be, but I would love it to be writing.
And how do you set about writing your books? You said you're squeezing out a few more words at the computer. Do you map out the whole story in advance, or do you start with one word and then write until you're finished?
Well, normally I will create one document, just called Clark Reaper Summary, for instance, and then write down a very quick summary. It's just a sentence or two of all the various stories. Like for the second story in this book being Showdown at Roswell, I just wrote the title of it and then Clark Reaper Fights Aliens. And then when I actually write the story, I figure out the situation that's going to put him in contact with aliens.
I don't know if you heard, but early on the show I talked with another writer, Eileen Carr, who writes under a different name when she's writing a suspense book. So
if you're
going to write a chick lit book, would you change your name for that?
I don't know. Actually, in this book, I have sort of changed my name. In the author's bio page, it lists, it has my last name is Michael Phineas Panish. And my illustrator is Jacoby Lightning Jake Delaney. But that was just for this book, though. I don't really have any intention of making that. My real middle name is Philip. I don't have any intention of changing it.
I love that page at the end, this sort of little ridiculous life story for you and Jake. And the drawings that Jake did of you, you've got a monocle and a fez on.
Oh, yes, it's brilliant. I actually got the idea of it from the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen comic books. And Alan Moore and Kevin O'Neill, the illustrator, at the author and illustrator page for that, they did, you know, very crazy Victorian-era biographies.
Michael Panish, novelist. His book is Clark Reaper Tales, the truthful telling of the adventures of the West's wildest bounty hunter. He speaks at Sacramento's Avid Reader this Sunday afternoon at 1 or 2?
2 o'clock.
2 o'clock. He's 19. He wrote the book while at high school. Michael Panish, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up in Marketplace, today's associate producers were Lynn Weaver and Rebecca Markison. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. How can a song suddenly elicit forgotten emotions and lost memories? On the next Insight, we'll ask two local scientists whose latest research links memory, music, and feelings in our brains. Plus, Nicolette Nieman and her book Righteous Pork Chop about the ethical production of meat. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow afternoon at 2 on Capital Public Radio.